You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 24th of November 2012 here on Monocle 24. The Stack is brought to you in association with J.Crew. A perfectly formed periodical on all things cozy and worth collecting, a German brand extension with staying power, a writer with the talent for putting tasty morsels on page, and a gentleman who chronicles what makes magazines tick. All that and much more today on edition 13 of The Stack. Also coming up on the program, we report on Magazine, an independent magazine conference in Turin.
We don't believe that all of the independent magazines are good. That is sure. Maybe you can find 10% of very good ones, but when you find them, they are
amazing.
Stunning.
Yeah.
We also hear from Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, who is giving us his take on Cover Junkie's top five magazine covers of the year, including that cover from Gentlewoman.
Whenever a new issue comes out, I always look forward to that moment when you discover what the new colour is they've chosen and who the new star is, and that they seem to have a real knack for understanding celebrity in a way that others don't, I think.
All that, plus a few more reading tips and quips live from Studio One here at Midori House in London on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 13 of The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly review of periodicals, journals, and other works of editorial art involving rich stock and sharp printing presses. Over the past week, we've been touring London's neighbourhoods and asking independent news retailers what sells and how they're approaching their sector. For many, it's business as usual with weeklies and monthlies, but sales of daily papers are trying to be offset by Kit Kats and cans of Fanta. In the coming weeks, we'll be looking at what makes for a good neighborhood newsstand as we cast our eye across 2013. But before that, there's plenty to get on with today, so let's meet our guests. We're just trying to get settled in here. One of our guests is spinning around trying to adjust his chair, as normally is the case. But first, I'm going to introduce Tim Hayward. Many will know him as the creator of Fire and Knives, a magazine which causes much excitement around the table here. Tim, good morning and welcome to The Stack. How are you?
Hi there. Great to meet you.
Good. You've got a lot to get on with. I can see food titles, but are we going to venture beyond food when we... at least try to deconstruct your stack today.
Absolutely. Please do. Yes.
Okay, excellent. Just tell us a little bit about the first time I came across Fire and Knives was probably, I think, where a place where I find most of my magazines, which is up at Papercut in Stockholm. Mm-hmm. And they've always got, if whenever you go in there, it's great. As soon as you go in right-hand side of the door, there's just always like loads of facings. And they've pretty much, they're out there to sort of display the full collection. Tell us, how did the title come about, and who's the follower? Because it's amazing. I meet people from so many different camps. Ones who you would think would only like magazines which are traditional in the culinary world, but they're enormous fans as much as people who just gravitate towards the niche.
I suppose it arose. I mean, I'm a food writer by trade anyway, and I just knew so many people who wanted to write enthusiastically about an area of food they were interested in, but the lifestyle food mags simply couldn't take it. There's nowhere really to put 4,000 words about cheese if it doesn't have a celebrity in it, and there's no real interest in picking that stuff up.
Would there still be room even if there was a celebrity? Anyway. <but. laughs>
And so, there's a problem getting in that way, and then also at the same time people were whinging, particularly online, about that there's nothing for me to read, I don't have anything on the nightstand, I would love to read something. And so using the sort of technology of zines, I guess, shoving those things together and making something that was funded by its own subscribers was a no-brainer. Mm. And as a model, it's now rolling on, moving on.
Which is brilliant. You talk about subscribers, but also on newsstand, cover price UK or US would be how much?
£9.
Right. Yep. So that also goes some distance as well, too.
We never anticipated having that kind of circulation. And funnily enough, Papercut were the first to pick us up.
Really?
And we've got a strange phone call from over over there, and they said, can we have some? And we sort of arranged it on the back of that.
So when it comes to newsstand distribution, as I was just touching on in the introduction to the program, how do you get the title out there globally? I mean, how did, you know, the likes of the guys up in Stockholm, but elsewhere, how do they find you? Because you're not, you know, part of course, one of the bigger, wider, more commercial distribution networks.
No, absolutely. And in fact, because of the amount that they would have to do on sale or return and then ultimately pulp, we probably never will be. We have a little distribution company we work with called Central Books, who do stuff into the little retail shops around museums, largely as their thing. And then over time, we've done a lot of backup work on new media through Twitter, that kind of thing. There's a big gossip about food nonsense going on, so we've used that. And then people request it. They request it from their local mag shop. If their specialist magazine shop doesn't stock it, they then push back to us. We put them in touch with Central Books. I think Central are doing a lot more international distribution as a result of this kind of thing happening.
And you are how many issues in now?
We are going into our third year, so 13 is the next issue, yeah.
Excellent.
We never imagined we'd go more than... In fact, we did a colourway for our first four issues. It was based on four colours of the original Penguin books. And when we got to the end of it, we suddenly realised we had no colours left. And so now we redesign every year as a beautiful response to our design.
Excellent. A gentleman, of course, who chronicles what you're up to, and of course, many other editors and art directors. Also a familiar name and face around the studios in the building here is Jeremy Leslie. Of Mag Culture, of course, one of the most influential websites, we'd venture to say, on the world of periodicals. And you've got a couple of good things to look at today. But I don't want you to, because we want to invite you back, Jeremy, later on to talk about where you see things going. But, you know, we're almost, it's almost December. We're, you know, the last quarter of the year is drawing to a close. How have you seen the progress this year? I know that, you know, this is, you know, people, I'm sure, you know, come to the altar of Mag Culture and want to know where the world is going. But yeah, if you look across the horizon, things looking rosy, or do you have a dim view?
In terms of magazines, I have a very positive view. I think it's been a very exciting year. I think certainly judging by my postbox every morning, there's more and more magazines being produced, and hearing Tim talk about his project, I think there's a whole range of magazines that have followed, if you like, in your footsteps and along various specialist subjects, which are finding exactly that same unique route through traditional genres of publishing and reinventing them.
Are you seeing postmarks from more, I would say, you know, more from the Netherlands or more German postmarks when you go to that into your letter bag every day?
Interesting question. It's actually pretty international. I think, I mean, this is you know, clearly, you know, Sweden picked up on your magazine very quickly. I think this is very much an international market. A lot of magazines are coming out of Europe, which are in English, and are looking to jump borders. They're not, you know, they're not local, they're international. And they're appealing to small groups of people internationally rather than concentrating on one place.
I mean, you know, we touched on Paper Cut. We talk about Do You Read Me in Berlin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there are many specialized newsstands or magazine you know, retailers out there now. Do you think we're heading more in that direction as well? I want to come to you on that as well, Tim, in a moment. As, you know, the major chains, and, you know, as I was again mentioning earlier, are just moving out of really sort of being in the traditional business of course, you know, out there distributing daily papers and magazines. And, you know, I was really surprised when I was running around London last week just to see, you know, how many traditional newsstands on the street, you know, what would have been a meter and a half devoted to various titles. You know, someone has you know, come in from, you know, Nestle or one of the other big confectionery makers, and it's okay, this is going to be chocolate territory now.
Or chocolate milk or
whatever it is. And do you think that actually opens up more opportunities maybe? You know, the neighborhood almost redefines itself slightly, and you know, those guys are going to not maybe the mom and pop shops, maybe of course the bigger chains, as we've seen with so many big chains, will go out of business. They sort of lose their mission.
People look at the situation now and sort of get depressed about, you know, the situation with the major stores, borders going down, etc. But I think there's also a great opportunity in the sense there has, you know, there's a massive boom in magazines over the last 10-15 years, which we're now kind of retracting from. And I think it's a healthy retraction. And I think similarly with the stores, it allows specialist stores to find a space and open up and develop markets for, you know, Fire and Knives and all these other magazines that we're going to be having a look at.
What's your view on that?
I think the specialist magazine sector, and we're obviously very much in that now, I think it's changed radically. And I think the magazine represents something very different in that sense. The great thing about the internet is, without any global borders, people with a special interest can talk to each other and communicate. Mm-hmm. Once you've got those communities, a magazine is very often a result of that community, a gelling of that community into a single physical purchasable object. Mm. Actually, it's a way of monetizing a community. Yeah. And that's the unbelievably unheard of thing online.
Yeah. Mm. But it also acts as a kind of membership card as well. It's something physical that...
Yes, and you make it beautiful, and then suddenly, oh, wow, we're in a whole new world.
Yeah.
Well, here's a big question for both of you, and of course for our listeners as well. Can a magazine ever be considered art? A group of graphic designers in the Italian city of Turin think so. That's why they started an exhibition conference celebrating the international independent publishing industry that's called Magazine. In a country that's become increasingly untrusting of its mainstream media, these titles are becoming more than just a collection of pretty pictures. Rather, they hold the potential to be a platform for Italy's youth. We sent Stack producer Adrian Craddock to Turin to find out more.
The city of Turin is famous for its sprawling markets. Sellers from around the world take on big supermarkets with deals on fresh berries, potatoes, and fresh cuts of meat. But just streets away, this fiercely independent spirit is alive in another form.
Normally, independent magazines are considered like bad quality magazines, or like if they were not enough. We don't believe that all of the independent magazines are good. That is sure. Maybe you can find a 10% of very good ones, but when you find them, they are
amazing.
Stunning.
Yeah.
That's Francesca Odino, one of the co-founders of Mag is In, an exhibition and conference celebrating independent magazines. With the help of her university classmate, Vanessa Polly, Francesca has called in some of her favourite titles. A Mexican photography magazine, an English language literary title from France, a graphic design publication from New Zealand. The pages on display come from all around the world. When I met her, she showed me one of her favourites, a travel magazine from Singapore.
Actually, Terroir is a very interesting project because it is a guy making it in his own house. He was buying this paper, this A3 paper, then he bought an A3 printer and he's making amazing pictures. And the concept behind this magazine is to have pictures of trips of the author and other people going around the world.
How many do you think he produces, do you know?
Not a lot. Like, when he was standing over these magazines, he just asked if he could have them back afterwards, and we were like, we're sorry, but we hope we're going to make more exhibition afterwards, so we would like to keep them. Yeah, we're keeping them.
Some of the most interesting titles at the exhibition aren't from faraway places, but rather are printed not far from the exhibition space. The Italian independent publishing scene is booming. Francesca told her views on why.
Actually, we think that for Italy, the problem is not the economic crisis. The problem is the crisis of values, because people are losing the sensation that they can trust their country. And that is what makes it really hard now. Taxation is going higher and higher, and at the same time, the quality of life in Italy is getting harder. So, yeah, it is actually pretty hard now. So the reaction could be in some way the way for them to express their need of a change that nobody listens to. Sometimes we think that nobody listens to. And especially what we want to do is to change the image that people have abroad.
For prominent Italian graphic designer Sonoli Leonardo, who spoke at the conference, the whimsical nature of Italy's new publishing wave means people should be careful about overstating its political importance.
Especially because these magazines that are exhibited downstairs, mm-hmm. also in Italy, are mainly publications made by illustrators, graphic designers, sometimes musician or artist. It's only about one word. It's not really, rarely they have an opinion about the society. Mm-hmm. It's just that it's creative or artist expression.
Either way, it struck me as interesting that the reaction she was talking about was coming from print. After all, it isn't cheap to start a magazine. I asked Francesca why these people would not just start a blog to express themselves.
Because they are crazy and because they love the perfume of ink and to touch paper and to have something that you can hold and sit on a chair and just caress. Because they're like freaks of paper, like we are. And so we just hope that these people are never going to stop to be crazy enough to do these things, because we are going to have great magazines to read still.
One of those crazy people is Harriet Alida Lai, the Canadian editor-in-chief of French literary arts magazine Her Royal Majesty. Harriet has been publishing since 2008 and now manages the magazine as a side project to her job at Condé Nast. She told me about how working in the world of mainstream and independent magazines compares.
Other magazines, like, that are through the Condé Nast family, they talk about sales in a very interesting way. So you're not only having to sell to the readers, but you're having to sell to the advertisers. And I think that that gives you a kind of freedom in a way, because you're working with so much more money and so many more people and over such a larger scale, both geographically and in an abstract money way, but it also inhibits you in some ways because you're not allowed to say what you want to say. It was really interesting talking to the editors-in-chief of all of the different glamour magazines, because they say that they feel that the role of an editor has changed a lot, and it used to be the one to come up with all the ideas and create an excellent and inspiring and fun feeling according to what your readers wanted, and be the one with the whims. You know, like Diana Vreeland, when she was the editor of Vogue, she's like, let's just fly 8,000 orchids to Alaska and have a photo shoot with whoever costs the most. But now the role of the editor is to kind of harness those ideas and monetize them.
Editorial freedom and a sense of passion is definitely at the center of OK Parking, an art magazine published in the Netherlands.
For us, it was very easy. We had dinner with the editorial crew and decided we had to do a thriller issue. And of course, you say thriller, you say Michael Jackson. So we said, okay, then we have to do the thriller song and we have to sing it. And to get that sound into a magazine, you have to get the sound chip. And we knew the postcards or the birthday cards, which you open and then you hear the crappy sound. So we thought we have to have that kind of chip with the crappy sound, because that's so nice of it.
I asked Francesca if some independent publishing brands can become hung up on this permission to be so wacky. Is it like the independent music industry? Do some readers feel alienated if a brand becomes more successful and is potentially bought by a larger conglomerate?
So we think that an independent magazine could grow up bigger, but if it still keeps its ideas and its way of behaving, it could be like Radiohead, no? The mainstream magazines have all of the spaces to display and to present their information. And these magazines don't have a place where they can be displayed, many of them. That, for us, it was important to present their immediacy. And that is why it's kind of an exhibition more than, an art exhibition, because we actually feel that they may be a kind of art.
Francesca is quick to point out that with many of the magazines on display, money is not the most important thing. For her, the richest titles, whether independent or mainstream, are not always the best. It's ideas, creativity, and innovation that are the real currency here. And more often than not, if you get that right, even in such a tough economic time, the rest will come later. For Monocle, I'm Adrian Craddock.
And that was, yes, our producer and associate business editor of the magazine as well, Adrian Craddock. So many interesting points there. I want to rebrand this program, just call it Freaks of Paper. what wonderful quote, wasn't it? It's just the idea, of course, you've got a former editors and passionate publishers are coming together. But I wanted to go back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier, though, which was, you know, this notion of the independent magazines. Or do you think there's enough just fairs for people to get out there? And, you know, there's ones for sort of the obsessive, you know, fanzine fan. But do you think we almost need to move into a place where there are quarterly conventions at a very consumer level for people just to get all of the stuff that's assembled around this table into their hands? Do you want to tell me anything?
I think we've bridged both markets. I think coming at it from where I did, it was just about the writing and about the food. And I love design. I have an art college background, and so it seemed sensible to find a great designer to do it with. And we've been really massively honoured by the attention we've got because of the design we have. And so I think, yeah, the fairs, the exhibitions, the groupings around that for people who collect and are interested in that area are terribly exciting for us, and we're glad to work with them. But it was a surprise. It wasn't what we targeted.
Right. What do you think, Jeremy?
I think there's always space for more discussion and more sort of sharing of these things.
But would we take it to a broader consumer level, you know, as well? I mean, it's great to have the discussion online, but at least we say you do want to hear,
this does give me the opportunity to mention a project that I do with Steve from Stack Magazines, which is called Printout, which is, it happens bimonthly at the book club in Shoreditch. The next one happens to be this Tuesday. Check out the blog if you want to see it. But that is very much what we're talking about. It's bringing together people. Tim's been down there, who make the magazines, to share and look at new magazines and mix up what, you know.
And can you purchase those as well? If you ask nicely.
What we actually do, people donate magazines and we swap magazines, we exchange magazines, right. And we do give away magazines. It's the complications of selling for another event, I think. But I'm very interested in the idea of bringing people together.
Quite apart from getting together so we can sell the stuff, the other thing that I think is happening a lot is as business people, I call it a business, what am I saying? But, you know, as people who run these operations, we're also getting together having really interesting discussions about the models for our business, what's happening in the media in a broader sense, and trying to understand that. Mm-hmm. And that's some of the really, really fruitful stuff I've had at meetings of that sort.
Yeah. I think this goes back, there is a kind of blog mentality in the sense that everyone's sharing. There's no, you know, a traditional media mentality is all keep it to yourself. Don't give away your secret. Yeah. This is very much about sharing.
Right. We'll come back to that. I almost have a sense we're never going to get to any of the magazines on the table today, but that's all right. You know, we're here every week. When we come back, we're going to be talking to our creative director, Richard Spencer Powell. It's going to be his view on Cover Junkie's top magazine covers of the year. This is The Stack. We're back in a moment.
J.Crew understands that tradition and modernity often lie hand in hand. That often means looking back in time for inspiration, pairing the integrity of traditional design with modern desires to fit and comfort. As head menswear designer Frank Mauchin says,
we're always inspired by art, architecture, nature, and we look at classic historical menswear, vintage army gear, and those were garments with integrity because they served a purpose. To us, J.Crew is about understated masculine elegance, and we're constantly tweaking proportions to keep the fit current and modern without being trendy, and so we're always moving. What makes it modern, I think, is the fabric and the fit. It's like modern traditionalism almost. Like the details are traditional, but then the fit, the fabric and the color, that's where you get all your updates.
J.Crew.
And welcome back to The Stack here on Monocle 24. I'm Tyler Brûlé. I think I'm Tyler Brûlé anyway. it was a late night, gentlemen. I'm joined by Tim Hayward, who is the editor-founder of Fire and Knives, and also by Jeremy Leslie of Mag Culture. Tim, I wanted to kick off. You've got quite a few things over there. What's the first title you...
I brought in Fool, which is... I think they're on issue 2 now. I've got issue 1 in front of me here. They're a Swedish... food and other things magazine, I suppose. It's a beautiful object. I mean, it's big. It looks like a proper magazine. It's very glossy. Got a lovely black and white front cover, and it should be everything I loathe really in magazines. It's got adverts in it.
And what are the top three things that Tim Hayward loathes in magazines?
There's just massive glossiness. There's a picture on the front of a chef, Magnus Nilsson from Fabrikken, and he's a big, sexy, hairy Viking, and he's wearing a fur coat. He's black and white. He's looking moody, and it says Natural Nilsson on the front, and you think this is, there's like a sense of irony in this. It's too bonkers. Food, right. Insanity, and brilliance. And it's run by a guy called P.A. Jorgensen, who's a photographer, primarily, but a real deep food nerd. You meet him at sort of conferences and events and things like that, and he's in the corner with his camera, and he's a quiet, enthusiastic, just lovely guy. And he's doing this with his partner, who's a magazine designer. And you get into it, and the photography is beautiful, the layout is lovely, extremely legible. The pieces are interesting, but they're just insane. And I mean, halfway through, there's a fantastic piece in here about a guy who breeds the ducks for Magnus Nilsson's restaurant, Fabrikken, in Sweden. And there's just 10 pages of amazing photographs of this insane hippie. And you get halfway through and you realize he breeds 5 ducks a month in season for the restaurant, and the eggs, as long as the ducks care to lay them. And you think, that's just almost a wonderful thing that somebody can get that deep and that mad. And I think what really marks...
Is that what converted you? Because you said...
Yes, absolutely.
If you looked at it on newsstand, and also just the cover, is kind of absurd. I mean, he could be from a Swedish kind of, you know, hangover of the late 90s indie rock group, couldn't he? And you'd have no idea.
Totally. And I guess... There are food magazines of all different kinds. There's this sort of arty left-field madness. There's very, very highly produced. There's lots of fine dining and beautiful objects kind of stuff that makes me wretch. but if inside every one of those, if you get one dweeby food nut and they can carry their idea through, it's so powerful. And this thing... You grow to love its nuttiness.
What's the name about? The name attracts me immediately, but fool.
Who knows? I mean, it probably translates into Swedish in some bizarre way. I don't understand. They never explain it. They don't. A fool is a kind of dessert, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Perhaps Fabican Nilsson is a fool himself, or Pierre Jorgensen is a fool to even attempt. Well, he's running a magazine. He must be bonkers. It's always going to be that about a magazine for me.
Right.
In there somewhere, that little germ of real enthusiasm that speaks to my nerdery.
Jeremy, do you think it has much of a lifespan? Because it just the passion and the commitment, of course, to doing any publication. But then I think also just the narrow nature of the thing that Tim described, mm-hmm. as well.
Well, that's always the challenge, isn't it? I think a lot of people enter into these projects thinking, oh, we'll do a magazine. And the first one is, we're going back to a music metaphor again, but the first one is really, you know, the one you put all your energy into, and then you've got it, and maybe you've sold some, you've still got some packages of magazines left, and then you scratch your head, oh my God, we've got to do a second issue.
Second album.
Can you keep
murder.
It going? Yeah.
Well, I think I saw a copy of Lucky Peach around the time. Very different as well, because, I mean, Lucky Peach, food and you know, definitely sort of sets its stall out as being an indie title, but you don't get that odd sort of paradox with Fool. I mean, I think Fool really sort of takes you by surprise, where you kind of know what you're going to get with Lucky Peach, but a similar type of exercise.
Well, I bought Lucky Peach in, very specifically, Lucky Peach 3. And amongst food nerds, you'll hear this sort of term passed around, Lucky Peach 3. That was where it jumped the shark.
And what happens in Lucky Peach 3?
Well, in Lucky Peach 3, each one was themed. And this is the Cooks and Chefs issue. Mm. And they've discovered, and this is McSweeney's, who in every respect, I think, are gods of publishing. Tremendous, tremendous people. But here they realized what quite a lot of us have quietly known for a while, which is the last thing you do is let chefs speak. If you can possibly avoid it, you know, it's like trying to interview footballers. You know, they're always going to say the same nine things. What this issue has done is given an enormous amount of space to chefs, particularly gobby, ballsy, macho men. There isn't a woman in this issue.
Right.
And they are just, it's, for want of a better expression, a massive pissing contest.
Right.
But
does it succeed as a pissing contest?
No, because halfway through, you're finding yourself, even if you love chefs, you work with chefs, even if you are a chef, you find yourself thinking, I feel a little bit ill about my ilk now.
Right.
And I think it's a wonderful magazine in every respect, but I think as we go forward, we are going to have to think quite a lot of the interest in food is being warped by mass media, largely, into a notion that it's about the chefs. It's about, and when you say food is rock and roll, or food is like music, food is like sport, food is new and sexy, they're simply by shoving somebody on the front cover in a fur coat and making him black and white, mysterious and fashion-y. Yeah, you're casting it in a new
you've
model.
You become marketing.
And once you've done that, and then you ask them to fill 19 pages with an interesting and intelligent discussion that rationalises what they do with their mushroom foam, the thing just grinds to a creaking halt very, very quickly.
Well, that's interesting, Tim. Jerry, do you think that, you know, once upon a time you would have, of course it still happens, but once upon a time you would have started up your own little title and you'd hope you'd sort of chug along, get to, you know, issue 3, and then the likes of, you know, a major corporation calls you up and hopefully they will, you know, write you a big check and off you go. It almost sounds like what Tim is saying, that, you know, you go from starting your title and they're just sort of hoping that, you know, you discover two chefs and there's a TV format or something else, that, you know, or you're able to do the licensing deal and you actually cut out sort of, let's say, sort of the bigger newsstand deal. Do you think that that's actually something which is happening, that this type of print that's around the table is actually spawning, you know, much bigger concepts, but it doesn't doesn't necessarily end up being a new volume where Benedict Tushin wants to do a whole bunch of sort of thematic, erotic cookbooks. You oh, know what those look like, heaven forbid.
I think everyone across all media is looking so closely at every little bright spark of creativity and then trying to identify how they can milk it. And I think in that respect, it's just very, very boring and repetitive. It just... I long for, the magazines I admire are the ones that just ignore all that and carry on doing what they're doing. And actually, the magazine is a centerpiece for a bigger thing that they're doing off the side, but they can carry on making the magazine. Fire and Knives is a great example. It's 13 issues in and it's just got better and better. It hasn't let itself become... glorified or celebrityfied.
Mm. I mean, I think a far more likely commercial model is that in your first or second issue, Diesel will sponsor you, because they're very, very, very good at hip, youthful.
They're very active. But they do it very subtly.
Yeah, some of the drinks brands, for example, might be in there and take you for a couple of issues. But the idea of anybody taking it and moving it on without it being massively compromised. Mm. Well, certainly when new food magazines start up, it's the interesting question for us is always, did they start from the... advertisers, or did they start from the subscribers? That's the big question at the beginning. Now, if they come from a magazine background, very often they'll get a couple of sales guys in. They'll have a couple of clients who are interested in buying space. You've got to have an office. You've got to have somewhere for the sales guys to sit. You've got to have somewhere for them to park their cars. You need £1 million to start rolling.
Credit card. Well, but
isn't there a third element, or that the magazine is just been started for the editors? Delight, and that's it. And if they happen to find readers and advertisers, great.
Yes, and I think...
I had a big fight with someone the other day, or not a fight, but just a very animated discussion. It's like, who do you do Monocle for? It's like, the starting point was like, we did it for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Precisely. Yeah. And I think what you're doing, interestingly enough, because this is very germane to what we're doing in our own mag, I know other people are doing it, which is moving into audio. Calling it radio seems wrong. Well, what we're actually doing is we're moving spoken word from written word into spoken word in a way that to us seems quite seamless.
Yeah.
In spite of the technology and the studio around us, in the same way as you can look at a magazine like mine and say, in a funny sort of way, that's a bit like a combined blog or some kind of website. I think it's kind of like a magazine.
A lot of these magazines, though, they start off with one terms of reference, and as it develops, the references change. You move on and you realise what you've got in your hands.
But we are definitely coming into a seamless media. I think that's really interesting. And in my head, the thing that's really important out there is that mad little community of enthusiasts speaking to each other. We have this weird phenomenon now that many of our original subscribers are becoming some of our contributors. Mm.
Would they be considered freaks of paper?
They are completely freaks of paper. They sniff the magazine when they get it. But the crossfeed between those who are interested, those who want to read about it, those who can write about it, becomes such a grey area.
Gents, we're going to try to seamlessly get to a break. And when we come back, we're going to be looking and chatting about Cover Junkies, 5 covers of the year. We're back in a moment.
The designers at J. Crew feel that the best garments involve a mix of smart detail and solid functional design. As head menswear designer Frank Mouchens explains, J. Crew's favorite products are the ones that start with smart design but last long enough to make them the customer's own.
It's, to me, DeLillo is a classic suit, but with a modern edge almost, but without it being trendy. And I think what we are in J. Crew here is we're looking for longevity and for classic garments which can lead a life. Like, if you have a khaki pant, we make sure it's nicely washed already again, but you still have to do the work yourself again. Like year after year, the wash gets better and it gets softer and it molds around your body. The same goes for denim. And I think also that's a way to give a garment personality.
J. Crew.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and Tim Hayward and Jeremy Leslie. We are going to now do a bit of an exercise. At least it was an exercise that we put Cover Junkie in charge of. We wanted them to name their top 5 covers of 2012. And we then asked our creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, to chat to our editor, Andrew Tuck, about the results.
We'll start with the top. Number one is, I'm not saying this is their number one, in fact, I do know which is their number one, but The Gentlewoman, a magazine also kind of out of the Netherlands in a way. It's part of the Fantastic Man group. It's Angela Lansbury wearing big glasses, an unusual cover. What do you make of it?
I love it. It's one of my favourites. I would put it in my top five of the year too, I think. Very nice pastel colour cover. Black and white photo shot by the photographer Terry Richardson. Those are his glasses, I believe. They're his trademark glasses. So there's a nice little insider's kind of trick there. And she's an unusual star. And they've got a real knack, a gentlewoman, of finding just sort of amazingly offbeat but recognisable people. Everyone knows who Angela Lansbury is. No one's ever seen her on the cover of a fashion magazine, and that's why it's so fantastic. It puts a smile on your face when you see it, and I think, and it's surprising. And whenever a new issue comes out, I always look forward to that moment when you discover what the new colour is they've chosen, and who the new star is, and that they seem to have a real knack for understanding celebrity in a way that others don't, I think.
And how amazing that Gentlewoman is brave enough to put a woman on their cover, you know, who's not 20, who's not even 30, who's lived a life, and just looks great.
Yeah, and I don't think they'll see a dip in sales from that. I think what the Gentlewoman do, which is different to everyone else, is exactly that. They're just different to everyone else, and it makes them stand out. And therefore, they can kind of do what they like, and they'll still stand out. I don't think they're being controversial. They're just not doing what everyone else is doing, like putting a 22-year-old Ukrainian girl on the cover who's in the Gucci campaign. They're just going for their own thing, and then it just everyone loves it. It's a real breath of fresh air. So good on them.
Good on them. So number two is the Süddeutsche Zeitung magazine. A great magazine. Interesting, I always think that magazines, supplements for newspapers, they don't actually have to kind of stand on the newsstand. They're kind of tucked inside the paper. So they can often get away with doing things that are a little bit more experimental. They don't have to worry about so many cover lines. And this is a visual trick. This picture is a woman, an Olympic hopeful. She's kind of lying back in the water, but they've turned the picture so that it looks like she's sitting up with the water about to cascade over her.
Yeah, it's an unusual cover. Like you say, supplements, they can kind of play by their own rules. So there are no rules, really. They don't have to compete with other supplements. They don't need to shout out. They don't need to have, like you say, multiple cover lines or little clever tricks and fluorescent inks. They just can be quite arty. And this is quite an arty image. But it's a bit of a trick. It's a little bit of a gimmick. It's quite poignant, the pose and the expression on the athlete's face is quite nice, but to me it's over a little bit too quick. It's not thought-provoking like some of the other covers in this list. I like it, but I don't think it would have made my top five.
Okay, next one from Cover Junkie is a Time magazine cover. Do you just want to explain this cover a little bit, Richard?
So this is the American recent US election cover. It's a special report and it's pre-election, and it's got two circles, like a Venn diagram. It has two circles on the cover. One says vote Romney and the other one says vote Obama. One's in red, one's in blue. And the vote Obama one is upside down. And they've taken quite a drastic measure. They've changed their actual masthead. They're traditionally just the Time bright red. They've made a gradient from the top of the page to the bottom of the page, a gradient from red into blue. So they've also got their logo on upside down on the bottom of the page. So effectively, if you look at the cover one way, it's saying vote Romney. If you turn the magazine upside down, it's a blue version of Time and it says vote Obama. So quite interactive, quite clever. Good for Time, actually. I've never been a big fan of their covers. I think they've often just used a cheap kind of Getty image, but I think this time they've spent absolutely no money and just done an in-house graphic, but it's a little bit more powerful than what they would have done if they'd kind of got an image of Obama and airbrush something on there, which is the way they tend to do it. This I like. I think it's a good.
And don't you think? I think what's nice about this is, you know, there's often, you know, we even have the discussion here. We've even done it. The split cover. You do two covers. You know, so the temptation always is in this scenario, I guess, is, you know, to have done a Romney cover and done an Obama cover and see who picked up one depending on who they're voting for. But in a way, they've done a split cover without having to print two covers.
Yes, and printing two covers is more expensive. So I think credit to them. They've been clever. And they've not overexerted on the budget. In fact, yeah, they've kind of got two covers for the price of one, and they didn't spend any money anyway because I think the whole thing's done in-house.
Now, let's pick the last, see the last two, both from the same magazine, Bloomberg Business Week, one of which is a red cover which says, It's Global Warming Stupid, and a picture of New York flooded after the recent Hurricane Sandy. And this was obviously picking up on Mayor Bloomberg's comment that it was time to stop pretending that global warming wasn't happening. You had to kind of vote in the elections, according to this reality. The picture isn't a great picture. It's a kind of very average picture of a flooded street. But I don't know, why is it, Rich, that they have these good impacts with these covers?
I think it's down to the style of the art director. I think it's Richard Turley is the art director, and he's an ex-Guardian art director, I believe. And it's a strong influence of information graphics. And if you're good at information graphics, you can send a message very, very clearly. And I think they know that strength, and that's what they play on. And again, it's something that you can generate in-house. So they're bold with their typography. It doesn't matter if they don't have a great picture resource, because the message is coming from both the wording, the styling of the type, and they're just very good at impact. In it, they keep it simple, they keep it bright, and they have had quite a lot of successful covers this year. And it's been talked up. I mean, in the design industry, it's been talked up quite a lot.
Now, their winner, could you just describe this for people listening in? And this is Cover Junkie's cover of the year.
This is another Bloomberg Business Week. It's a bright orange cover. It's the cover line is for Euro Crisis Relief. Bang head here in a large black circle. It's simple. It would work as a poster. It would work as a stamp. It's just, it's simplicity, and it's a great message. And I think it's succinct. It kind of crystallizes all the news that had gone before the previous, however long we've been chatting about the Euro crisis. And I think, again, it's a little bit of light relief in all of the, endless drudgery of, economic crisis on the front page of everything.
And I think what's great about their art director is that he's like a kind of like a visual or a word cartoonist almost. You can imagine a cartoonist every week trying to write something that was topical that kind of summed things up with, one or two characters. And he does that with a few words. Almost every week he has something that's clever. You can see the connection between all the covers. You know what you're getting. But yeah, they're funny.
They are. And I think the challenge of something like Bloomberg Business Week, as it was with Newsweek and Time, is weeklies must be very difficult to work on because you haven't got much budget for a cover. You haven't got long to think about it. So you have to be, a simple idea has got to be the way to go because, you haven't got the resources to do anything other than that. You haven't got time to plan a shoot and spend the money and retouch it and try different options. So I think you have to be on the top of your game and you have to think fast and work fast. And although these are two very good covers from Bloomberg Business Week, I find they can be a little bit hit and miss because sometimes I just don't think they can get the right image in time and the right message. But you're right, the last few weeks, few months, there's been some real good ones in there.
But can I ask you, without rubbing your patting yourself on the back too much, looking at the Monocle's covers for the year, is there one that stands out for you that you think, out of all the covers we've done this year, that's my favourite?
There were probably two. It'd be a dead heat, I would say. And they're two difficult ones to design. I quite like the covers that are the surprising ones that didn't go the way you'd like. But there's a little bit of a story behind it. And one is the Japanese dog cover. And sometimes you need a bit of luck with a cover, and it just worked in our favour. It's a great story. It came out of nowhere, and the models look good. The dog looked good. The dog's haircut is great. And you've got a good cover when people in the office who are wandering past your desk and see you working on it come over and they sort of aghast and say, "Wow, is that the new cover?" So that one's a real favourite, and just very, very nice colours. The cherry blossom matches the Pantone ink. So it was a real joy to work on that one. And then the big summer issue where we've done a composite cover. And composite covers are real jigsaw puzzles. You don't really know if they're going to work. You have to keep swapping images. And this year's one, it just fell into place perfectly. And from the kind of sort of 50, 60-year-old Danish ladies that are very elegant to our handsome cyclist in Zurich to the Australian swimmers and the beach volleyball players in South America. Every image really is beautiful. There's even one of the Flatline building in New York, and it doesn't even look like New York. It's so sort of bright and sunny. So every image was surprising, and they all kind of sung together, and it just pops off the newsstand, and I think it was a successful one.
I love them both. Well, thank you very much indeed, Richard Spencer-Powell. Between it, you and me, we've got it covered.
Nat was our editor, talking to our creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell. I mean, is that a mark of a good cover? It was just, you know, wonderful listening to them, and we have the images in the studio now, but I could think of every single cover, you know, right away, yes, as they described, yes, them. I absolutely said, yes, mm-hmm, I remember that one, whether, you know, whether it was the Coffee Business Week that I saw at our newsstand or actually had it on my desk. The only one, you know, as we're saying as well, you know, So Deutsche we do get, but, you know, I don't get to the, you know, to the Friday edition of the paper when the supplement is in it. But, you know, Jeremy, you know, to you, would of those, how many would be in your top five? You know, from Gentlewoman all the way through to the two Business Weeks Times and that Süddeutsche one.
Three of them would easily make it. I think the two Bloombergs and the Gentlewoman.
Mm. Tim.
The Süddeutsche image is superb. I think it's absolutely lovely. That one hit me through Found a while back,
right,
and I just stared and stared and stared. And the Gentlewoman, it actually stopped me walking past the newsstand. Literally stopped me in the street, and that just doesn't happen. Jesus, is that really?
Yeah. Is that Angela Lansbury?
Yeah.
Or was it that Elizabeth Arden, slightly Avon, just pinky color? It was so off, but so right as well.
But for that magazine to say that woman is still relevant and sexy, just mm-hmm, it makes you choke up.
Yeah.
God, that was powerful. No, I loved it.
For me, what was great about the Lansbury cover was that I think the Gentlewoman would struggle with one of the two of their covers, trying to find their identity in a way that Fantastic Man never did. But with that, it's suddenly crystallised in front of you. It's suddenly, okay, I get this now.
That should have been their launch cover.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Tim, how much, because you bridge this interesting territory with Fire Knives, that it's, you know, on one side it feels very literary, and you reference sort of the you know, the Penguin colour tones at the beginning. But of course, you know, there's enormous impact with your covers at the same time. But do you sometimes say, because of the collectability of what you're doing, even the cover price, that I'm slightly in book territory, and there is that wonderful bookish feeling about what you're doing, but I'm also periodical as well, and is that sort of an art direction conflict in a way for you?
It's not really a conflict at all. I mean, Rob and I get together once a year and come up with what the next one's going to be. There's usually a sort of a theme to it, but it's something that we know that we can go back to, and I trust Rob will make it phenomenal every time. The second year we decided,
you make it sound so easy, just once a year.
But honestly, it is that easy. Now we have this, you know, facility that we to work online to pull stuff together. I mean, the second year we commissioned a designer to design what wallpaper would have looked like when designed for the Festival of Britain if it was around food. Not much of a brief, but it was brilliant. And the designer, who was a fabric designer, came back with amazing stuff. That was good. And then this year we just decided we were going to buy very, very, very bad 1970s tea towels off of eBay. And print those. And actually, when Rob decided that he was going to print the inside covers of the back of the same tea towel,
right,
so you have the half print coming through.
Touch. Yeah.
It was, I mean,
yeah,
but that's the kind of thing that Rob can do.
Yeah.
And I think that the logo work was important, because that will tie us through pretty much everything we do. It has that kind of timeless quality to it, which is very much part of the brief. So no, I don't think we have a conflict there. But it does give me a chance to do everything I can to say how phenomenal Rob is, because without him we would be nothing.
Mm. Jerry, I saw you have Wilder somewhere around there. You brought that in. I had it in my stack as well.
I've stolen it from you.
Yeah. Well, you've got it. It's on the other side of the screen now, but that's fine. I'll both of you. Do you want to start on it? Why did you bring it in today?
I brought it in because it's a magazine I've been following for a while. This is the new issue, the fall issue. It's from America. And it's another example of a magazine that is ostensibly about quite a narrow subject, but it grows that subject around. So Wilder Quarterly, essentially the theme running through it is gardening and outdoor life, but it allows you to do, there's a little bit of fashion, there's a bit of cooking, there's some science in terms of aquaponics and stuff. But there's one particular shoot that I want to draw attention to here, which sort of sums up a lot of what we're talking about today, and that is it being fall and winter's approaching. They've done a series of shots of different types of sweaters, traditional knitting style and sweaters. No, you know, no big deal in one sense, but it's all about the feel of them.
Mm.
And they managed to get across in this shoot the close-ups of somebody wearing it and screwing up the wool. It gets across that tangible feel of wool and the warmth and coziness of it, and they do that very well. And yet you turn over and 2 pages later you're looking at crystals,
right?
So the scope of it is it's a lovely broad set of things to do with outdoor life that can almost do what they want.
Yeah. How important, Tim, is format as well? Because this is, you know, by European measure, it's A5 largely, to also get that feel, because I want to bring another title in a moment, but just format, how it works for it.
Gosh, I mean, there's a lot to say about it. I think it boils down to one quite simple thing in my head, which is because of the format we've chosen, which is also around this kind of A5 style, everybody's a little bit confused as to whether we're a magazine or a book
right,
or not.
Yeah.
And that also, a lot, along with your price point, that works really well if you understand that it's not a problem. I think people like to be confused by that. I think readers do. Mm-hmm. I think also, it's another point about Wilder. I think what we can do with independent magazines is we have a kind of idea about something, this idea of being halfway between a magazine and a book. We can't articulate it. It's not something you could ever pitch to a bunch of backers. Mm-hmm. But it sort of was. With this one, you know, there's something going on with outdoor sweaters, crystals, not idiots or greenies or nutters doing it, but actually quite intelligent people. What's this? There's no name for it. I can't pitch it to you. But these guys have done it. And now there are people in magazine offices all over the world going, you know, it's kind of a Wilder kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
I know. And they said, you know, a long time ago, they were saying that about Fire and Knives. You know, we couldn't articulate what it was we did, but people were then saying, that's these bellwethers, these indicators, lightning strike things for culture. That's what we can really do in a very, very powerful way.
I feel I have to bring in kinfolk as well, because oftentimes you see, you know, Wilder and kinfolk sitting side by side, and I wonder what your view is. Do you think there's that same sense of passion for that as well? Because certainly a lot of people love that magazine. A lot of people also want to, you know, fling it across the room screaming as well.
It's very stylish, but also very cold. And I think this is what I was talking about earlier. When you have something inside that fills it with warmth and passion, you know, even the spelling mistakes don't bug you anymore. With something like this, where the stylishness is so massively there, but it doesn't have that heart in it somehow.
Well, I'm also wondering, going back to the format, though, if Kinfolk was smaller, you know, would it just, the actual page real estate was not, you know, sort of beyond A4, would actually have a different level of intimacy, because the photography is beautiful. The layout is, you know, is good, but yet sometimes I think there's too much white space.
I think, I mean, the format is an issue. I mean, it does take it into another realm in one sense, but actually for me it's more just to do with the, it's quite repetitive. It just lacks that heart somehow. I do know a lot of people absolutely love it, and there is a space for it there, but given something like Wilder, where it's there's no surprises in it. And I think magazines, I want to be surprised when I look at a magazine.
Right.
And even some of one of the things that's great about Bloomberg Business Week is it's a massive commercial operation, but those covers surprise you constantly.
Well, I think also what's surprising is when you open up Kinfolk, as soon as you get into the inside flap, there you've got, you know, Bonnier, which is one of Europe's biggest publishers. I mean, one of the biggest, I mean, still, you know, it's a family-owned operation, but nevertheless, they've really sort of stamped the mark, this is ours. And then in the back, it talks about this cozy community they're trying to, I know, and those two things jar, sort of the you know, the corporate stamp at the front, and then, you know, how we're this collective of artists, etc.
Well, the Bonnier link doesn't concern me so much. It's actually when you start having to talk about the community, it worries me.
There's right, a sort of, well,
actually, that's where, you know, the problem comes. You open a copy of Fire and Knives or Wilder, and you don't get an editor's letter saying, welcome to our community.
No.
It's a given.
No,
it's
exactly.
Yeah.
No, it's. I just wanted to bring your attention to this. I just wondered what you make of Neon as sort of a brand extension. It's the one I brought in today, because, you know, sometimes they also absolutely sort of nail a cover. But the idea of taking something, you know, that grew out of Stern, but, you know, it's trying to, you know, Germany, of course, you know, it's a very healthy newsstand, and at the same time, they're doing something kind of quite interesting and political as well. And yet, it sort of continues to run. And I wonder if you think this would sort of work in the English language world, Jeremy.
I'm. Being English, I don't have German, so it's hard for me to judge the content too strictly. I'm aware that the Stern have a number of spin-off titles and a very healthy range of different projects. I can't
Can't read it.
I can't read it.
Literally. How important, you know, because interesting how important also how they managed to also sort of use that. I just, you know, the iconic Stern White star is interesting, and how they've been able to apply that device across a number of things, their magazine, Nido, and many others. But we can probably do a whole program on brand extensions another time. I can see you looking at your watch, Jeremy, because we can see that clock ticking away.
Well, I'm interested to know more about it, but yes, maybe afterwards.
No, we can do a show from Berlin at some point. I think it'd be great to sort of anchor it from a Do You Read Me? Just probably one last thing, and we've got about 15 seconds, Tim, because you're new to the program. One last pick before we go.
Last pick.
Just one thing. If anyone could pick up one magazine this week, what would it be?
Of this lot, I would say Wilder.
Okay.
I am so sold on Wilder now.
Excellent. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, gentlemen. My guests today have been Jeremy Leslie and Tim Hayward, and our producers are Don Trump and Adrian Craddock. Sitting on the other side of the glass, Toby Hammond has been in charge of the sound for this program. If you have any comments or queries for today's program, then do drop us a note at info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. I also believe there's an interesting little magazine event that you did mention, which is going to be on Tuesday, right, Jeremy?
Tuesday evening.
So, yes, anyone who's in London, they can find it via your site.
If they have a look at the Mag Culture blog, it's right up there at the top.
Excellent. We're going to be back next week. It's also going to be our Christmas market. Lots of fantastic print, which is going to be inside Midori House, also out in our courtyard as well. Santa's coming down from Finland. We've got reindeer and much, much more. So it's goodbye for me. The review is coming up in 1 hour's time.